welcome to the latest episode of the Accessing Justice podcast from CommuniCourt. In this episode, we're sharing the opening address delivered at our 2023 Access to Justice conference by His Honour Judge Neil Clark. Appointed to the North East Circuit in 2012, Judge Clark has participated in a number of initiatives relating to both special measures and independent sexual violence advisers, known as ISVAs, at Leeds Crown Court. This opening speech explores the justice system's ongoing journey towards improved accessibility for vulnerable people. Listen in as Judge Clark shares both his personal experiences and his considerable experience in the courtroom to unpack why he believes steady evolution, not rapid upheaval, is needed to continually improve access to justice.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. It's an honour to be here today and to be invited to speak to you all. Now, what I say today are really just my personal thoughts. I'm not a representative of the MOJ giving talk today, but I hope that I can address some of the issues and explain to you why changing the system is not just a process pushed by politicians, pushed by the civil service, or pushed by formal lawmakers. It's pushed by individuals, and often in part for their own reasons and in part because what they themselves have seen and have been concerned about. And all of you, whatever role you play, I don't know what everybody in this room does. I know there are some students, there are certainly some intermediaries, there are some lawyers, there may be some ISVAs, that's independent sexual violence advisors. Each one of you plays a part and has the potential to play a part in ongoing change and review of the system, and you should all remember that that is important. So why did it become something that I was concerned about? And if I might be allowed just to mention a couple of things, some professional and some personal, and I hope you forgive me for that. The first one that really drew things to my attention was when I was a very junior barrister. I was working in London. I was at the Old Bailey doing a very minor case. It's not some grand case I was in. I was probably applying for bail in a shoplifting or something. But I came out of the court I was in, and I was lurking around in the public area when rushing out of one of the other courts came a really distressed female witness. She was crying her eyes out and shouting. And she was shouting, "You don't know what it's like." It was really quite horrible to see. And shortly after she came out, a group of fairly senior barristers came out, some QCs, things like that. They looked nervous, a bit upset, and so on. I knew some of them to talk to. None of them were unpleasant people. And they were clearly, in their own way, if you like, although they must have been doing their job, upset by what had occurred. And it occurred to me, even then, there's obviously something wrong with the system here in relation to this. I asked them what the case was about. And they say they were nice people. They said, well, it's a rape case. There's a lot of defendants. And each one says, you know, the account given by the complaint isn't right. And we're each having to put this, and that's what had caused this enormous upset. They clearly knew it was wrong, but they were doing their jobs as they were back in the 1980s. But it seemed to me that this isn't fair. It's not just unfair to the witness, because they get distressed, and in the end they're not answering questions that helps anybody, including the defendant. It's not really helpful to the professionals who had to do it that way. And frankly, I've got to be honest, it occurred to me, if I was a defendant in a case and innocent, and the witness became as upset as that, I would think that I hadn't been treated fairly, because in the background of the minds of the jurors is going to be the thought that you're responsible for doing that to somebody. And so it seemed to me that the system ought to change. And it did, and it's been changing for some time since then and before then. When I was a young barrister, obviously I didn't get involved in cases that were particularly sensitive or serious. That happens as you develop in your career. And I'm glad to say that as things developed, you could see things evolving. And by the time I was involved in those cases, the way in which people asked questions had changed. The manner in which they asked them had changed. Not like you see on TV, where to make it dramatic, people are grabbing the edges of their gowns and shouting at witnesses. But people tended to ask questions in a gentle and polite way, rather than in a threatening way. Counsel, if there were many of them in a case, would very often get together and agree that one of them would ask the questions that were common to all, and the others would then just ask follow-up questions unique to their defenders, thus saving repetition and ongoing upset and delay. So things were developing, and those sorts of things have carried on. Those sorts of developments were just natural. there were people seeing there needs to be change, there needs to be evolution. But it doesn't just arise for professional reasons. And this is where I touch on a personal matter. When I was still a young barrister, my mum developed a really unpleasant degenerative condition. Some of you might have heard of it. It's called multisystem atrophy. It's like extreme Parkinson's disease. It's very, very unpleasant. And it causes somebody to become disabled, but in the true sense, in that they lose an ability. As things get worse, one ability after another goes. And throughout her illness, before she died of this, Mum never lost her mind, if you like. She was always bright. She was always intelligent. She always had a sense of humour. And I'd sometimes go to court and I'd see people giving evidence. I'd think to myself, what if my mum saw something happen? Could she give evidence? And as things got worse, one of the things that she struggled with was speech. If you knew her, obviously my brother and I, we knew her well. We knew how she expressed things. We were used to how she degenerated and how she'd sort of have to breathe between words and take gaps. We also sometimes knew what she was going to say next anyway, because you could kind of predict it once you knew her very, very well. But other people wouldn't. Ultimately, that would have meant that people wouldn't have relied on her as a witness. And why not? Why should she not be a witness in the case? She's bright, she sees things, she hears things, she's perfectly able to describe them if you give her the opportunity to do so. Now we have intermediaries. Most of you, I'm sure, know what intermediary is, but that's somebody who will meet a witness, find out what their speech or personal difficulties are, how they communicate, how they best express themselves, and probably could help with that. But when Mum had her condition, there really was nothing like that available in the courts. But other things too. It's quite interesting to see Chris Packen there. Other things occurred to me as well. It's not just a witness. What if Mum was called up for jury service? Why shouldn't she be a juror? Well, ultimately, there'd be a position where she wouldn't have been able to, or she'd have been so unwell with her breathing, I think she'd have disturbed other people. But for a long time, why couldn't she? Perfectly able to see things, hear things, make her mind up about things. And yet, no facility for that. And even now, I ask this question, why is it when we do build courtrooms, don't want to be too political, we haven't built many for some time now, but when we do, why do the jury boxes not have something for somebody who might use a wheelchair, as Mum did latterly, or one of those electric mobility scooters? If she had been called up for jury service, I suppose people wouldn't have refused it, but she'd have had to sit out on her own, standing out, frankly, like a sore thumb. She'd have been embarrassed. It would make her reluctant. It'd probably embarrass other people. They'd react differently to her in court. Why have we never thought about that? What about justice being dealt with by everybody in society, including those who can sit on a jury, but might have, and I use the word disability because she had lost abilities, become disabled, such as my mum? So it seemed to me that there were obvious things that ought to change, and we ought to make allowance for those things. It's not just prosecution witnesses, it's jurors, it's defendants, it's virtually anybody. You all, in a way, have your own needs. Some people's needs, if you like, require more effort by the rest of us than others. Well, as I say, these changes happen by evolution, largely. People try to adapt. But there have been pushes recently to improve things, and improve things quite dramatically. As I say, all of you, whatever position you're in now, even the students coming into the legal profession, will ultimately be in a position to affect change, and you should always try to do that. But what I would say is there should be a word of caution. It should be evolution and not dramatic change simply for change's sake. But change has been quick, and I apologise to the lawyers for this, but those of you who aren't lawyers might be surprised by this. And just think about it for a moment. It wasn't until 1851, and looking around the room, quite a number of us were born in the 20th century, wasn't until 1851 that a defendant in a civil case could give evidence on oath at all to defend themselves. So if somebody was suing them to get money off them, somebody wanted to stop them doing something, get an injunction against them, somebody wanted to make them do something, anything like that, they weren't even permitted to give evidence in their own defense. That's fairly shocking, really, and it's not that long before many of us in this room were born. And if you think that is bad, just wait for this. It was 1898, with the passing of the Criminal Evidence Act, that a defendant in a criminal case was first allowed to give evidence on oath at all. Stop and think about that. Some of those people were on trial for their lives, and they weren't permitted to give evidence at all on oath. They could make an unsworn statement from the dock, but frankly, they were largely valueless. They were short. Everybody says, well, you're bound to say you didn't do it, didn't you? It was a bit like that. It wasn't tested. They weren't able to say, I will get up, I'll tell you about it, and you can question me, and I'll show you why I'm right. Not until 1898, 66 years before I was born. If I said to any of you now, if you put it in context, back in the 1950s, you could be on trial for your life and not be allowed to give evidence, you'd be horrified. And so you see that things were changing. And they changed probably for good reasons. There will have been a reason why people couldn't give evidence, probably because for a long time most people were illiterate. The courts used very formal language and used Latin. And for serious cases there was representation, often free, but you know, somebody would turn up, a junior lawyer or somebody who was a senior lawyer with no work might turn up to represent them, but that was about the extent of it. But by the 1890s, people were getting education. And thankfully, people noticed, and ultimately politicians noticed, and they changed the law. And 1898 just happens to be synchronicity with something we'll come to in a moment. But that change has carried on at an enormous pace, and I think it's increased significantly recently. And I'm grateful, really, to the court service for giving me a job in Leeds, because Leeds has been, I think, at the forefront of change, certainly in criminal cases. One of the things, as you were told a moment ago, that I've been involved with, is what's called Section 28 of the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act. And that was brought into force in 19, or rather it was put on the statute book in 1998, 100 years after defendants were given the ability to give evidence in their own defense. And what that provides for is that a complainant, a witness, something like that, a person in that position who is vulnerable, they can have their cross-examination recorded in advance of trial so that it can be played back later, removing, for those who need it, the unnecessary nervousness of going to court, removing the worry about waiting, and, when ultimately the section was brought into force, controlling the way questions were asked in a more formal way than things had simply evolved. And by the time that came into force, which sadly wasn't until about 2014, even though it had been on the statute book for 16 years or so, there were already in place other special measures for witnesses. And just to give you a list of the types of things, TV links to rooms that are remote from the courtroom, so that a witness who's nervous about speaking in public or seeing people they don't know could give evidence from a separate part of the building. Screens for witnesses who don't want to be seen by the public. There were CVP links, which were introduced relatively recently and are available for people who live a long way away. And the courts became much more willing to adapt to the needs of individuals. With Section 28, there came certain formalities which were necessary for the Section 28 procedure to work, but also dealt with the needs of witnesses. We saw intermediaries becoming used much more frequently. The need for them was spotted because the cases had to be dealt with early, and once that need was spotted, people were seen by the intermediaries who would help with how can questions be asked of this witness? How should they be phrased? Does the witness require, for example, something like a fidget toy just to make them relax within the room? They're simple examples of things that came into force at about the time Section 28 came into force and were advanced because of the Section 28 procedure. Formal rules about how questions could be asked by advocates were also introduced. Every advocate dealing with a sexual case has to undergo special training. And the Advocacy Training Council, which I was involved with when Section 28 first came in, developed a set of rules and specific training for it. And you're lucky Miss Melly's giving evidence later, and she's been active in ensuring that that has been rolled out nationally. And she's one of the, if you like, I don't want to big her up too much, but one of the best advocates at dealing with this type of case that you could ever wish to see, because she knows exactly what to do and how to do it, and is ahead of everybody else on the training. But there were now rules, and there was a requirement for training, compulsory, before people could deal with these types of cases. Hopefully, no more witnesses running out of rooms, crying and upset. Sadly, you're never going to get rid of that entirely, but it has reduced significantly, I think. Well, other things have been introduced as well. I don't know if we have any ISVAs, independent sexual and violence advocates here, but if not, what they are is somebody who can be with a complainant, in a sexual case usually, throughout, from start to finish, from the moment that person goes to the police station, they can ask for them. Their role is really just, if you like, to advise, to be a friend, to explain what the process is, what's going to happen next, what could you ask somebody to do, where should you go, what should you do, what are the options open to you. They can be there with them throughout, and I think, for some people, that is a huge advantage. When Chris Packer mentioned, really, he was talking about not being familiar with the process, not being familiar with the room. If you've got somebody like an ISVA, well, hopefully you'll be more familiar. They're there to talk to you. They'll have some experience of it. And that, I think, is another important development and something we can maybe utilise in other ways in the future. And I'll come to that in a moment. I emphasise personal thoughts, not the MOJ's thoughts, just in case anybody thinks about that. We now have, as well, a remote site known as the SARC, Sexual Assault Referral Centre, in this area, which means that a complainant in domestic violence or sexual case doesn't even need to go to a police station. If it is appropriate for them, then they can go to this centre. It's remote from a police station, it's remote from a court. They can make their statements there. If they need medical examination, they can be examined there. If they have to give evidence, they can give their evidence from there, both in pre-recorded evidence and in any cross-examination, either live on the live link or a Section 28 early cross-examination. Again, not necessarily something for everyone, but it's there for those who need it. And that's really the key. It's for those who need these things. We shouldn't, I think, always push every new thing onto every particular person, but we should try and utilise the tools we've got for the needs of the individual people involved in cases. Well, as I say, those things are hugely helpful. Intermediaries can be enormously helpful. Just 2 weeks ago, I had a case with a witness who was struggling with a relatively simple question, but just couldn't get their head around what the question was. Everybody tried to rephrase it, and eventually, the intermediary managed to explain what the question was. It wasn't a complicated question. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was just the fact that this intermediary was with the witness, knew the witness, and was able to explain, this is what the question is, and get the answer which everybody was hoping to hear. Well, what should we do to change things in the future? Well, I think we should always think to ourselves, do we need the change? And should we rush it or should we evolve? And the answer is we should always try only to evolve, but we should never rest on our laurels. When we have effected a change, we shouldn't always think it's necessarily right or that it won't be changed in the future. We should look at it and see, well, can we improve it? Do we need it? Do we need it in all the situations we've been using it in? Could we use it better in other areas? And an expression that's used in sexual cases where a witness gives evidence in advance in chief on a video recording, they're called ABE interviews. It stands for Achieving Best Evidence. And that's quite a good way of thinking about it if you're dealing with a witness. What one or more of these particular tools we now have available to us will help this person achieve giving the best evidence. Not necessarily saying to them, you've got to use all these things because they're there, but looking at that person's needs and saying, well, what will actually get them to give the best evidence? And I have to emphasize this. Achieving best evidence doesn't necessarily mean just from the point of view of the prosecution. It means from everybody's point of view. What is the best way to get this person to give their account and also to properly answer the questions that they're being asked, where the account's being challenged? So that's what we always need to reflect on when we look at how we use the different tools that are available to us. But I've spoken really about the situation we're in now, principally in the criminal courts. But there are other areas that we perhaps ought to consider. Because people who require assistance, be they nervous, so I focused on really complaints in sexual cases because they tend to be the most nervous of witnesses that I come across, but other people get nervous. Some people need help because they have difficulties, such as my mother's that I mentioned. Some people suffer from dementia and so on. What we need to do now is reflect on what can we do for people with all those range of problems, and not just in the criminal courts. And in criminal courts, for example, why is it that we focus principally on the cross-examination of complaints? I mentioned to the guys from HMCTS and MOJ earlier, it strikes me always as odd that although there is the facility to have an intermediary at the giving of evidence in chief, the achieving best evidence interview the police conduct, which forms the evidence in chief of a witness, it's hardly ever used. It's used in some cases, but it is a minority of cases. Well, if somebody needs an intermediary when they're being cross-examined, which is usually the shortest part of their evidence, how is it they didn't need one when they were being examined in chief? Well, it's something that perhaps we ought to give thought to. What about civil cases? You all just think, or most people would think, I'm probably being rude to say you all just think, most people would think, well, commercial cases, who cares? Well, stop and think for a moment. Civil cases aren't just commercial cases. People have had accidents. People have been discriminated against at work. Some people, even in a commercial case, they might have had a business, they might have been the victims of a fraud, and now they've developed dementia. Why shouldn't they similarly have access to justice? Why are the facilities that have become so readily available in criminal cases, principally sexual ones and domestic violence ones, but why are those facilities not being rolled out more quickly in other areas? There may be practical reasons, but we ought perhaps to think, well, could we help people achieve justice in the civil courts, for example, by rolling out these sorts of provisions for them there? In criminal cases, what about defence witnesses? Defendants sometimes make applications, but defence witnesses? I've never, ever seen an application for one. Now, there are practical reasons why that will be difficult. But why can't we address the rules to see if we can deal with that? The practical reasons, frankly, are these. If you're a defence advocate, the last thing you want to do, frankly, is call too many defence witnesses, because it only needs one to get it wrong and your whole case is gone. But there will be witnesses who you have to call who might need assistance and whose evidence will be improved by the special measures that are now available to the court. So how do we get around the problem of the defence perhaps having to reveal what their witnesses planned to say, because they may not say it? Well, perhaps you can do that by not telling the prosecution, have the judge and the intermediary and the defence there in advance approving the way the witness will give evidence and setting some rules. But at the moment, it simply doesn't happen. Other things we could reflect on are these. Well, do we always need what we use at the moment? So I say intermediaries have been fantastic. But there are certain areas where maybe we only need to use them in some ways. So I'll give you an example. In many of the cases I've been talking about, the witness is a child. And the intermediary really helps with the way the questions are asked to that child because they've got to know them. But if on the whole, that particular child is really just an ordinary child of 10 or 9 or whatever, once the questions are agreed, and you've got a judge who's been specially trained, you've got an advocate who's been specially trained, you've got questions agreed with the intermediary, you've got witness support present in the room who've been specially trained. Quite often what happens is the intermediary sits there and of course they've done their job. And the witness just, in fact, with most of them, the witness just gives their evidence straight through. It's just a thought, but would perhaps that resource, because it's limited, be better then moved to having help with the ABE in the first place about how the questions are asked, because they've really done their job by helping with the questions on the cross-examination. When people apply for intermediaries for things like defence or defendants, perhaps the applications could be more focused. Instead of saying, well, the whole case, and I know most, they don't always ask for that, it's about one third they don't. But what about the advocate saying, well, this defendant really will need help in these areas? The cross-examination of this witness where the facts will be difficult, the giving of this particular speech, the giving of evidence in chief, but probably not in the scientific material or the legal arguments, so focusing perhaps our resource on specific areas. So really it comes to all this. There are many things that have become available to us. They've become available to us with increasing regularity. The process has sped up over the last few years since 1898. But now we perhaps need to look at, well, how can we use them for other areas? Because it's really been rather focused in certain fields. And secondly, are we using them in the best way in the field we currently use them in? The answer to all that is, I don't know what we do. All we can do is try and do what I hope I've tried to do in my career, is just try and help, and try and help things along. Each one of you can play a part in that, and should play a part in that, if you remain involved in the system. Don't, whatever you do, affect change for change's sake. And all of us should always remember that whatever we do, in the future, it will be changed, because we won't have got everything right. But at least, as long as we do what we do with the best intentions, trying to be fair to everybody in the process, well, then nobody can criticise us. And I hope that that's what all of us will try to achieve. And that's certainly what everybody in this room is trying to achieve. That's probably why you're here at this meeting. So thank you. I hope that was of interest. It was a bit disjointed, but I hope you got some ideas about why things change. It's not just driven for professional reasons. It's not just driven by politicians, but sometimes driven by just people, their own thoughts and their own experiences. And you should always use those to guide you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Accessing Justice podcast, and an enormous thank you to His Honour Judge Neil Clark. If you'd like to learn more about the role of intermediaries in legal proceedings, CommuniCourt has developed a library of free, bite-sized resources for legal professionals called the Access Brief, which is available through the CommuniCourt website. In the Access Brief, you'll find guides to working with an intermediary at all stages of proceedings, as well as specific guides to working with a client who has a diagnosis impacting their communication, from autism to traumatic brain injury. Thanks again for joining us. Join us next time when we'll hear from presenter and environmentalist Chris Packham, who shared his experience of the courtroom as an autistic person in a pre-recorded video for our conference.